honorable members, good morning. I'm told there's a problem with the projector, so they are trying to sort it out. Probably in the meantime, we could use our documents to proceed so that we don't lose time. Let me now check if everybody has a copy. We all have. Sorting out the copies, those who have to grab some tea or juice, you can do so. There's tea and juice and sandwiches, you can do so.
Yes, I noticed it was working until the HR the sea walked in.
What, the project?
I cannot believe this chair. Can we inform the committee that we actually got the best laptop that we
have? Okay. You are leading the delegation, so I will allow you to introduce your team, and whoever is going to present will present, and you will then engage. You are welcome.
Thank you, Chair Mushikiri and honorable members. To start with, I'd like to convey an apology from our CEO, Professor Ali Sisana, who could not make it this morning. I am accompanied by a number of senior executives from the HSRC. I lead the program on HIV, AIDS, STIs, and TB. My full name is Lightness Zimbari. Perhaps I should actually let each member of our team introduce themselves briefly, starting with my colleagues on the right.
Thanks very much. My name is Ivan Turok. I lead the Economic Performance and Development Unit of HSRC.
I'm Dimitri Labadarios. I'm the Executive Director Lead of the Program Population Health and Systems Information.
I am a research director in the Education and Skills Development Program, and I'm here on behalf of our executive director, Dr.
Well, my name is Daniel Blackett. I'm responsible for the democracy government.
Would like to thank the committee once again for inviting us to share some of our observations on this year's draft appropriations bill. For me, this is one event we look forward to each year because we are able to share with the community information based on some of the evidence, research evidence that's available. And we hope that that helps the community in performing some of its duties. We have prepared, as you will see from the presentation, to make comments particularly on allocations to education, health, governance and service delivery, and lastly, the economy. And essentially, the idea is that each one of us will take turns in presenting. And perhaps you could decide whether we are going to break it up in bits or we present, and then we have a discussion afterwards. Thank you.
Yes, Rob, you can present, even if you are people, but let's do the whole presentation so we have the whole picture, and then we have a discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, colleagues. Is this sound okay? We here have prepared for you five key trends that engage with the belief of interrogating the effects of an efficient utilization of financial resources in education. And this first slide is making the argument that in fact education gets the largest slice of the budget pie. Because what we did is we consolidated across the budget all the items that went to the Department of Basic Education, the Department of Higher Education and Training, and the provincial allocations to education. And we come up with some interesting trends that, sorry Daniel, you're looking away. The dark that you can't see is 10% of the total spend on education that goes to higher education, and we've seen how little goes to skills development, 9%, and it was 10% to higher education. This 18% is what goes to administration within the provincial allocation. And the 8% is what goes to DBE in the national department. The lion's share, 46%, is going to the provincial allocation and on salaries. So we see an anomaly that while DBE is held accountable for all education spend, in fact, a large proportion, the 46% plus the 18%, is under the direct control of the provinces. And the issue is, how do we hold the provinces more accountable for delivery in education and for effectiveness and efficiency in education? So when we do it like that, it leads us to question who is accountable. The second issue we wanted to raise is, if we're talking of efficiency and effectiveness, how are we actually going to judge that? And what's very useful is to do international comparisons. So we've got on this slide a comparison with some very developed countries and some comparison developing countries. We are now in the BRICS, so we have, we have India and Brazil, as well as USA, Norway, and then Kenya as an African country. And we've looked at public spending on education as a percentage of GDP, as a percentage of government expenditure, on primary education as a percentage of GDP, and on secondary. And you can see that South Africa is in the top 10 in total. It's very high. It's also in the top spend on as a percentage of government expenditure, almost 20%. And then the closest comparator is Kenya, and thereafter Brazil. And the same with expenditure on primary and secondary education. But the question is, are we getting value for money with this huge proportion of our total government expenditure, 20%? And what we did is we compared performance measures between South Africa and Kenya, given that we have a very similar percentage of total government expenditure on education. And what you have here is a SACMEC 3 evaluation of maths and science in 2007, and we find the reading scores, Kenya is higher than South Africa, on the math scores they're higher, and that is very disturbing. And then what's even more interesting is when we look at the general population of those who are functionally illiterate and functionally innumerate. In South Africa, we have 40% functionally innumerate as opposed to 11% in Kenya, and 27% functionally illiterate. And this is really significant in terms of general social development and enhancing social capital. Because what's very important in South Africa is that we need to raise literacy and numeracy levels overall. When children coming home to do homework and to be learning, they need higher levels of education within the home. And so we need to raise the levels of education not in schools, but equally within the general populace and in adult education. The first thing we wanted to show is to look at the proportion, as you saw on our first slide, 46% of the total education spend was being spent on teacher salaries through the provinces. So we wanted to interrogate the issue of teacher salaries in more detail. And we've looked here at the proportion of salaries as a percentage of the total allocation per province. And you'll see that Gauteng has the lowest proportion of spend on salaries, of teacher salaries. So they are spending 23% approximately on other educational issues like textbooks, training, infrastructure, and so on. And you'll see the highest is almost 80% in the Eastern Cape of the total budget is going on teacher salaries, which does not leave much leeway. All the provinces in terms of textbooks, training, other educational aspects that have been shown to have impact on effectiveness and efficiency. But there's also another anomaly here. Although there's a high proportion, and we must admit that this has increased over time because about 20 years ago the proportion on teacher salaries was more than 90%. So it is decreasing over time. But it is still high, and there's an anomaly because when we look at teacher salaries, we find that they are really low. So if you look at a newly qualified educator with less than 5 years experience, they are earning approximately 115,000 per year. And a teacher with 5 to 9 years experience has a salary between 124,000 and 146,000 per annum. And these are professionals that are responsible for the quality of schooling and of education. So that is pointing to the complexity of the problem in that we have a high spend on salaries, but individual salary teachers with a 4-year qualification and 5 to 9 years experience have a relatively low salary as a professional contribution. And that has a negative impact on retention of teachers within the teaching profession and within the education system, and certainly in the public sector. To take this point further, we've done a very crude measure of the relationship between achievement, educational achievement, and the proportion of budget spent on salary. So on the horizontal axis, we have the from the previous table, the percentage in each province that was spent on salary. And on the vertical axis, we have used TIMSS 2011 data, the mathematics score. This is a crude measure. And we find an inverse proportion. That Gauteng, if you recall, had the lowest proportion that spent on salaries. So they're spending more on textbooks, on training, on infrastructure, etc. And their achievement is higher. And you see that the same with the Eastern Cape as the most of the teachers have. Now, obviously, please don't take this as a causal relationship. It is not a causal relationship. It's a correlation. So the two are strongly related, and it's pointing to something that we need to investigate further. And that is to interrogate what proportion of our budget we're spending on teacher salaries in terms of educational effectiveness. And the final issue where we can point you today is to point to another complex set of factors that impact on effectiveness is a very controversial issue of student funding in higher education. So we've seen a major increase in spend on the national student NSFAS funding, and we've seen a very large amount, 19.9 billion, that's going to be spent on approximately 700 students in higher education and almost 850,000 in TVET colleges. Although the amount has declined slightly this year. However, and you'll have seen this in the press, NSFAS has increasingly had developed a negative reputation, and there's a strong call that there's insufficient funds to meet the number of students. But more significantly, there are problems with the administration of the NSFAS system. Late payments to students, problems with universities, inefficient delivery of the NSFAS system. So a priority is that the NSFAS mechanism for delivering funds to students needs to be improved and strengthened, which is a case of a good mechanism but inefficient delivery causing ineffective delivery within higher education and causing extensive conflict within higher education that disrupts the efficient functioning of universities. And that is the education presentation, and I will now hand over to help and take questions later.
In the first slide on health, you will see that there's an increase compared to 2014-15 of 8.8%. That's good. And the total budget for health is 157 million. Everyone is very grateful to acknowledge the increase. What we did in the next slide is address the sources of funding. In this complex slide, it's not easy to read. The importance lies in these two bars, that being the public sector, thank you, and that being the private sector. You can see that these two major chunks. And this one is actually out-of-pocket expenses, which cause a lot of grief to a lot of people and contribute to having pool of access. The next slide against this type of source, the next slide shows you the pattern over this period of time, 2009 to 2014. This being year 2009, number one down here, and the five being 2009. And you can see five administration costs right here in the bottom. all the other techniques of expenditure has actually increased steadily at differential rates. So the important thing also is that in relation to the priority of the National Health Insurance, the engineering of family healthcare, in future we expect that it will cause a disproportionate increase in district health services expenditure. The other important thing over this period of time is that we still spend a significant proportion of resources in hospitals. And the word hospital-centric has been used in terms of resource allocation. But let's actually be very careful because we started from the academic hospitals and we had to reorganize things, and these are changes that take time and need to be done with care. Importantly, in the last bullet, is that expenditure on health sciences and training hasn't really increased significantly. And if one bears in mind what has been allocated over the years, the calculations are that we need twice that amount at least in order to train enough people and actually have the facilities available where they are most needed. This expenditure pattern should also be seen in the next slide in the context of the NDPs. In other words, where is it that we are going? And what we want to live longer, so our life expectancy is to go up to 70 years. We want to have a young population free of HIV. We want our children and mothers to survive, so mortality is important. And we have this burden that was predicted as coming that is communicable, and importantly, non-communicable diseases, your diabetes, your hypertension, your heart disease, and so forth. And importantly also, the implementation of the National Health Insurance, which has to be implemented in phases. It is a challenge, but it must also be, when implemented in part or full, must be supported by better human resources and better systems that one may have at present. So the last slide of the presentation, which is the next slide, at least the presentation on health. The thought, actually more than thought, the recommendation, or at least consideration must be given clearly to investing more money on HIV and AIDS, that's prevention and management, maternal and child health. No members, since 1994, undernutrition among young children has been 20 plus, stubborn and high. Haven't made an impact on it. We've done a lot of other good things, but we haven't made an impact on that one. And, you know, if anybody heard or read the papers this morning, that is the topic that we are not doing there. And we need to understand. And the context of the comment is that we do have, or we need to have, more allocated funding at the national level, particularly in the first 1,000 days of life. That is where the damage, or that is where we miss the boat, in the first 1,000 days of life. That consists of the pregnancy, the duration of the pregnancy of the mother, and the first 2 years of the infant and the child. So that is extremely important, and together with that is the communicable and non-communicable diseases. We have now data on this. This is really fascinating in terms of prevalence of risk factors. And in terms of health systems, there are important resources that need to be set in training and health workforce, improvement of the public sector, the Office of Health Standards Compliance. It's a major development, welcome development, but it needs to be supported. Health infrastructure and management, we need new infrastructure.
And then, of course, one has to regulate to the extent possible and with negotiations the private sector to the extent that it is possible. And the national health insurance in relation to scaling pilot activities, which is testing new things, one of which, just as an example, with the dispensing of chronic medication, which is really the single most important cause of delays and long queues in public hospitals, which is not well received by the public. And the last important point, of course, is the funding of the universal health coverage, which the general opinion and the trends and international trends is that it is a key activity to have in any one country who started on that too. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, I will continue on the health theme, but focus a little bit more on HIV/AIDS, given the magnitude of the problem in the country. To start with, one wishes to commend the government for contributing about 80% of the cost of our national response. This is in comparison with countries in this part of the world where most of the funding comes from donors and bilateral partners. So we have no choice but to carry on doing this. Overall, as was indicated, the budget is 36.46 billion, which is an increase compared to last year. Just to provide a background to where we are, I've added a few slides which tell this story. According to the last national survey, which we conducted in 2012, we found that about 12.2% of South Africans were estimated to be living with HIV. This actually works out to 6.4 million. This was an increase compared to what we had found in 2008, where 10.6% of people in the country were living with HIV. So there has been an increase of some 1.2 million in that four-year period from 2008 to 2012. The question is, why or how did that occur? We can only make educated guesses, and one is the fact that if you have a successful treatment program, as we do in this country, we have more and more of those living with HIV and AIDS who are eligible for treatment being put on treatment. It means people are living longer and fewer are dying. Unfortunately, we are still getting more new infections happening, at least as of 2012. I'm pleased to share with the committee that we actually are planning to repeat the survey this year and early next year, where we'll be able again to see what has happened over the past 3 to 4 years. But then our challenge is that we are still getting new infections, so it's pointing out to the need for prevention. Just to share with you in terms of the rollout, I'm sure members, honorable members, would have heard from the budget board speech by the Minister of Health that we now at about 3 million people who are receiving treatment. this has really been tremendous progress since 2004. If you can see in the graph, it just shows that there has been this enormous increase from 2004 through to 2011, where by 2012 we were 2 million, and now it's estimated just under 3 million people have initiated taking ARV treatment. This is a tremendous achievement. So, however, beginning from the 1st of April, which is this month, there has been a change in policy with regard to treatment. And this relates to what I call treatment guidelines. And internationally, the World Health Organization has recommended that treatment be started sooner rather than later. If members will recall, at one time, a person was eligible for treatment if they had a CD4 cell count of under 200. 2 years ago, this was increased to 350. From this year, and this is across the world, it's being increased to 500, which in essence means that people will start being put on treatment while they're actually feeling okay, because that CD4 cell count is a measure of how well the body defends itself. So we're going to have a lot more people. Rather than the 3 million where we are, if the estimate of 6.4 is correct, probably there is another 2 million people who will need to go on treatment. And this is going to cost more than we are spending at this time. It's commendable that one of the biggest increases, at least I noticed in the health budget, has to do with the increase in allocation to provinces with regard to the comprehensive plan for HIV and AIDS. It is provinces which implement our response on the ground in the districts and local government levels. This has increased by 45% from last year. And clearly, given the fact that we expect more people to enroll for treatment, this is going to help. A recurring problem we have had is actually occasionally you hear about stockouts of ARV drugs. Part of the rationale for increasing the allocation here was really to prevent drug stockouts from occurring. Perhaps just to strengthen the case of why there is need for more allocation and for us to be more vigilant in terms of our national response, has to do that with the fact that when we did our survey in 2012, we actually got a mixed picture. While we were doing very well in terms of treatment and other biomedical prevention campaigns, like, for example, trying to prevent the spread of HIV from mother to child, which is almost diminishing. We, unfortunately, as I indicated, are still getting new infections. So that is really a problem. Perhaps let's share another good story. We have been able to test large numbers of people in our country successfully because of the national HIV counseling and testing campaign. That's progress. But unfortunately, where we have setbacks is in prevention, and in particular what we call behavioral and social prevention. I'll just show a couple of slides briefly. The first one is this one, which shows the level of condom use. The HSRC with partners has undertaken repeated surveys every 3 years since 2002. If we look at that, basically, it shows that each year we have seen in the total, even when you break down by sex. Sorry, this is showing awareness of status. I apologize. Overall, the HCT campaign has resulted in almost two-thirds of people in South Africa being tested. That's great. That's why we have quite a large number of people on treatment. On the other hand, where we're losing the battle is we kind of moved our eyes from the ball, particularly with regard to prevention. And this beautiful slide here really summarizes the story. You will see in each block of in the graph that the first three show an increase, and then the last one just drops. The last one is showing 2012. Somehow something happened by 2012 that condom use dropped. We have been doing very well prior to that, and this was both for young and old, as this graph shows. So hopefully the idea is that we should not focus too much just on biomedical approaches, in as much as they are good, but we should make sure that we also close the tap so that we don't get any more new people becoming infected. Otherwise, it will be a vicious cycle that we need even more money as we go forward. We have to remember that people are on treatment for life with ARVs, at least in terms of the drugs that are currently available. So the 4 to 5 million people who will soon be all on treatment until there is a new treatment available, the expectation is that they will carry on taking these drugs for the rest of their lives. And that's going to cost us quite a bit. I'll try to finish up. When reading through the appropriations bill, it's commendable that there is funding going to NGOs. I'm sure we could do better because a lot of NGOs, smaller ones in particular, get funding from donors, particularly PEPFAR. Something that I just noted, which is of concern and I'm aware of it, has to do with the allocation to the National AIDS Council. It's only been allocated 15 million rand. They are meant to coordinate the national response. Perhaps they could do with a little more. They are depending on donor funding from the Global Fund to do what they need to do. I think we could do a bit better there. And finally, allocations for our HIV response have not only been directed to the health budget, but there have been allocations also to social development, and social development are an important player in the national response to HIV because they do provide funding to a lot of the other NGOs that are actively participating in this process. Higher education and training also have some allocation, particularly to higher education aids program. They are doing a commendable work. They too perhaps could do with a bit more funding because they do rely on donor funding quite a bit. They are covering all the universities and all of the further education training colleges. The Department of Science and Technology also has been able to allocate funding, particularly for innovation with regard to HIV and AIDS, and indeed other diseases in the country. I think if we are to win the battle against HIV, as we hope by 2030, we need actually to keep on increasing allocations like these in the coming years, because given our middle income status, other donors are cutting down on the funding that they are providing to South Africa. I think that's the end of my question. The next presenter is for this budget.
Thank you very much. Again, morning, honourable members. What I'm going to briefly present is just a quick snapshot in terms of the association now, the balance of growing governance and democracy to African society. I think this slide is quite important because it shows that there's probably an improvement in satisfaction of government performance since 2003 to 2012. And obviously it looks at the broad question that moves from social grounds, education, electricity, working sanitation, refuge, removal, access to healthcare, specific AIDS treatment. We've heard about, my colleagues spoke about in this case, the AIDS treatment take up with regards to that. Affordable housing, in particular, discussions around the RDC housing, land reform, and climate reduction and population. What you see is that there's a consistency, especially on since 2005 to 2012 on social grounds, there's quite good satisfaction around that for citizens. And the same on the levels of electricity. We're really struggling, especially with regards to government performance, is on job creation was very low of far the low of 8 in 2003, and it remains at the level of 7% satisfaction. 2012. So there's seriously a need for much more harder thinking and intervention with regard to that, but also reflective of the current patterns of what's happening in society with regard to labor and economic activity, but also happening in poverty. There's also the very low on crime reduction. Clearly South Africans are starting to feel that not much has been done to reduce crime or to keep themselves safe. And that in itself suggests that from outside borders we need to have some intervention in regards to that. Similarly on land reform, the satisfaction survey shows this, that the citizens are unhappy with the sluggish land reform that's been taking place over the last 20 years, and clearly that it has managed only in 2005 to move beyond the 30%, and it came down radically again to 23% satisfaction. And then on affordable housing, the same. So the fourth and bottom seems to be in line with current thinking with regard to a fast-track response that needs to happen in order to, on the one hand, to deal with the levels of inequality and the stubborn poverty that people in our country are experiencing. So these are, in many ways, the satisfaction that citizens indicate. The percent in satisfaction of electricity is indicative of the rollout of electricity, especially to historically areas where historically not receiving electricity supply. So you could, depending where you stand, you can look at this in terms of where we come from to where we are, and in some instances, for instance, on sanitation, water and sanitation, the argument could be that these are, in most instances, clearly in lower rental areas, or other low areas of housing, as opposed to areas of resettlement areas. So be that as it may, there is a degree of satisfaction that shows that it has broken beyond the 50s. first team all, and so striving to grow out of the season and the season. So that's essentially what the satisfaction survey shows. There are possibly policy questions that you can actually direct for it, but in many ways, given the nature of the sampling, it is indicative of where the citizen sees the performance of government. The other matter that I want to touch on is the emerging work that's been done with regard to how the also the appropriation speaks to the search for the golden nuggets in traditional practice and systems, but also to strengthen its the nexus between positional affairs and constitutional law. And the department in particular through the appropriation seems for us that its provision is made for promotion and coordination of research, information management, governance, policies, preservation of traditional effects. One could argue that the current bills are based on a relatively good assessment of the various traditional practices and it's finding its way into policies and legislation, but also holding constitutional responsibilities, constitutional law in our country. There is a need to build coordination of and assist institutional development capacity to enhance efficiencies and effectiveness within the institution of traditional affairs. And clearly there are matters that requires quite a harder thinking and work to link the behavior and practices of institutional structures and systems with the constitutional law. We think that the research in particular, but also the appropriation to take in consideration, especially in living people, poor people live under traditional systems. But there are concerns, like in many other aspects of government departments, that a lion's share of the funding goes towards salaries and stipends for position leaders. And then obviously there's some requests made for additional increase items. So those that make equal with the public service. And that in itself raises policy and legislative question that requires yourself and others, honorable members, yourself and others, to look at. And our view is that it's the need to increase investment in development of traditional institutions of governments. So there's also then obviously a need to look at the relationship between traditional leadership, traditional councils, and municipal councils to ensure synergy in local development. Clearly there's been concerns with regard to how municipal councils interact with traditional leaders and the mutual influences, either in mutual self-supporting the nature of local governance within a particular area, or the one possibly undermining the other with regard to that. Obviously noting that on a municipal council side, it connects the people to the capitalistic system. On the traditional side, it's traditional leadership because of questions of issues of hierarchy. We have the view that there's extensive municipal capacity building of traditional leaders. And there's certainly a focus on that, especially on local context. The section that talks to rural development confirms there's a need for increased integrated comprehensive rural development and performance monitoring related systems to measure performance and appropriate models of rural development. The allocation seems low in comparison to the needs for infrastructure, because the need for especially in the rural provinces, because the component of institutional capacity within the equitable sphere doesn't make adequate provision for historic backlogs for infrastructure development in rural municipalities and rural provinces. In fact, there's also a lack of economic development in those areas. And you've probably heard from my other colleagues in the Commission that there are questions with regard to increased investment and increased economic development of the Latin and mining areas. But the limited response from equitable share locations when it comes to these provinces and municipalities. And in fact, historically many of the municipalities in some of these rural areas, the equitable share, the conditional ground allocation, or even the allocations they get from national debt directly spent on paying off debt, in particular ESCOM. So there is a need to look at improving rural development, and there are responses to the appropriation that needs to be sustained and create more rural communities. The appropriation will, in part, works towards the verification of the separation of powers. This is one of the smart moves was to establish the office of the Chief Justice. The history around that funds for judges and the judicial system in via the budget of the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development. And having a mandated budget through the appropriation as a confirmation and it solidifies the independence of judiciary and the role of the apex court, the constitutional court. In many ways, it's by doing this, it ring-fences the operational and strategic leadership responsibility management and support services within that particular sector. We also think that the Secretariat and Administrative Support Services to via this vote to the Judicial Service Commission helps to strengthen that. From our investment research, especially regarding the separation of powers, but in particular looking at the implementation of the judgment by institutions of government, of state government, it seems that there are arguments that suggest that we need to have a constitutional dialogue where all the altered governments could really try to share ideas about how to create a better life for all. There is the whole question that, which is a healthy tension, the role of Parliament and its work relative to the role of the executive, relative to the role of the judiciary, and the elements of giving up a Parliament like in the Portuguese or other constitutions. How do we bring the different influences, forces together that will serve collectively in the interest of our citizens, given our historic remnant of the past, but also the historic problem that we have of continuing inequality between our citizens as a result of stories about development, but also issues about redistribution, but also issues about how to really see, look at other interests, whether it's from capital to the utility of political power to bring about changes. And obviously noting that the system is much strongly driven by political negotiated outcome relative to the economic questions around us. The strong agreement from our research that separation of powers has to continue to maintain independence, and that the courts play a very important role in constitutional reform, and that the legislature and the executive must comply. I'm reminded that Justice Charlie Sachs said at the recent meeting which reconvened the program of democracy and government in SRC, that we struggled for the country as we have, but we didn't struggle for the society that we currently have in place. This is quite a suggestion that we need to look at the critical issues with regard to how we deal with that. So there is a role to look at how do we deal with that, but also how do we ensure compliance with this issue to ensure respect for the rule of law within the country, and that the courts are able to do this without some moreover, there seems to be some concerns with regards to who has actively played a role with regards in terms of pushing socioeconomic rights within South African society, and the arguments that comes to the fore from various stakeholders is that the government institutions have a little been slow at the custodian of some of these responsibilities, and that we are experiencing a donor funds are drying up, and that this probably is obviously a need to look at our Chapter 9 institutions are being beefed up to play a much more vigorous and active role with this, in particular the Human Rights Commission. Our viewers suggest that from our work that there's a need to look at the legal aid board, and the board's mandate should be expanded to help citizens, especially those historically and currently continuing being marginalized, to deal with socioeconomic rights. And these can obviously serve as a primitive dispute resolution method offers and not deliver them to courts, which are possible. The public service, confirming with other colleagues, is that the NDP obviously is infrastructure and global development of the economy, physical and social infrastructure. There's a need to look at review the supply chain management system. There's obviously both talks to ongoing cost measures and various capacity programs. So what is required is support for these implementation for governments as a whole. There are a number of policy proposals in the board of promises to identify future skills gaps in the labor market, and obviously this should not relate to demand-side factors to encourage uptake of labor, especially among youth, and forecasting future skills required in the public sector. So the goal tries to mitigate against potential fiscal risks. So there is a strong move towards consolidation. However, there are pressures from the public sector wage growth volume outcome. A need to properly look at the cost implications and the serviceability to national health insurance, the security Canadian Society of Reform and University. So the view is that the appropriation will consolidate fiscal position of the head service level of the citizens. It continues with the engagement of growth, which is an international phenomenon many instances, but also in many instances response to the 2008 and 2012 fiscal meltdown problems in the world to provide benefits and spillovers in the economic development, social development of citizens. The key question is, how does this committee see itself in ensuring that citizens do benefit in major ways on the infrastructure investment? And I think the Presidential Infrastructure Commission can also help, particularly in looking at the spillovers of the billions of land that's going to go into infrastructure, but also to help stimulate local economic development in those areas where it's going to happen. Thank you, Chair.
My colleagues have been talking about how to spend government money. The other side of the equation, of course, is how do we generate the resources that we spend on health and education. And, of course, it's vitally important we don't neglect the generation of funding. The context is not a great one, of course, not a very positive context. We've seen economic slowdown in the last couple of years from even the rates of 2 or 3% 3 years ago. That's partly because of the weak global economy, and Europe in particular doing badly, but it's also because of domestic factors, as senior government politicians have admitted, including things like industrial relations problems, extended strikes, and such like. The effect of the slowdown is that government debt has risen quite quickly, from 24% of GDP in 2009 up to 45% now. So that's government borrowing in order to sustain spending on social programs. So the effect of this is that there's a large budget deficit now of 4%, or equivalent of 4% of GDP. That's the difference between spending and tax raising across government. It's not you know, extraordinary by international standards, but it's large, I think, is a fair description. And the other consequence of rising debt is that we now are spending more. In fact, the rate of increase in budget servicing, debt servicing, is growing more quickly than any other element of government spending, right? So debt servicing has been growing at 10% on average since 2009. That's interest payments. That's faster than any other component. So it's obviously a concern. Growth of public sector staff, my colleagues have talked about, particularly in health, of the increase in staffing across the public sector. This has obviously contributed to the increased spending, 15% per annum on average since around 2009. So that's quite a big increase in government. In fact, it's one of the biggest elements of the increase in employment that there's been over the last 6 years, in public sector employment. So the question it raises is, are we getting the payback from increased staffing? Are we getting the payback in terms of better services? And I think the evidence, the jury's out on that question. The climate for investment is not good. The confidence of business and consumers in the economy is not good. The energy crisis is just symptomatic of the troubles that we're facing at the moment. So the end result of that is that the Minister of Finance didn't have much room for maneuver in terms of stimulating spending in the budget. And so it's quite a cautious budget in terms of the spending side of it. And indeed, the word consolidation was used by my colleague. And that summarizes really a shift in approach. So if we look at the top of the next line, there has been a shifting approach compared with the previous minister, Pravin Gordhan, who was gently pursuing a counter-cyclical approach of stimulating during a slowdown. The current minister is pursuing a more cautious approach, not necessarily for ideological or any other reason, but because I think circumstances are different. There is less room for maneuver. So there are modest tax rises in this budget, and there is a slowdown in projected spending. Not an actual cut in spending, but a slowdown in the projected rate of increase in government spending. The two principal increases in tax are personal income tax, up 1% for people earning over about 182,000 rand a year. And that's the first time in two decades that personal taxes have risen. So this is quite a big change in policy, even though the increase is very modest in terms of the scale. And the second big element of tax increase was the fuel levy, taking advantage of the decline in the oil price to increase the fuel levy by 85 cents a litre, which is quite a big hike. The slowdown in spending, the rate of spending growth, right, rather than cuts in spending, a 2% reduction in budgeted spending. So previous estimates of how the spending would increase over the next 3 years have been reduced by 2%. So it's a modest reduction in projected increases amounting to 25 billion. And the second aspect that the minister is committed to is freezing public sector headcount. This is quite a, the media have been questioned whether he will be able to deliver this, whether the Treasury will be able to deliver this. And it is a change from what we've seen over the last 6 years or so of increasing employment in the public sector. Finally, a tougher approach to managing state entities such as State Southern and Airways and others that ESCOM, including the sale of non-core assets. Again, commentators have questioned whether the Treasury has the will and the capability to follow through on this desire to restrict loan guarantees and such like for state entities, state enterprises. Infrastructure, as Dan, my colleague Dan has emphasized, is a long-standing theme of government through going back to the New Growth Path, the National Development Plan, and the Public Infrastructure Infrastructure Coordinating Commission. There are very mixed messages about whether the government really is delivering on increased investment in infrastructure. I think a message now coming through more strongly is to encourage private sector investment, perhaps reflecting the fact that government has less resources itself, so it's trying to stimulate the private sector to invest in infrastructure. Major construction companies continue to complain in the media about the lack of new contracts. It's interesting that some of the smaller construction companies seem to be doing better. It's the big ones that are complaining the most about the lack of new spending on infrastructure. In July, in a couple of months' time, the Treasury is holding a very big conference to try and raise awareness of infrastructure investment opportunities. So I think this is consistent with that second bullet point, that you know, the way it's trying to raise the profile of this, trying to attract more interest from the private sector to say, come on guys, these are the kinds of projects we think you could invest in. Another distinctive feature of the budget is the increased emphasis given to maintenance of infrastructure. So we've rolled out a lot of infrastructure over the last 10 years or so, but we have often at the expense of maintaining existing infrastructure, and now the government's recognizing that with problems with ESCOM and with other water leakages and so on, sanitary breakdown in sewage treatment, that we also have to maintain our infrastructure and not just build new infrastructure. The next, second last slide of mine is a growing emphasis on cities in this budget. So a couple of quotes, well-planned and well-managed urbanization can accelerate economic growth. Secondly, realizing the economic dividends of urban growth requires a new approach to providing infrastructure, housing, and public transport services while overcoming the spatial divisions of apartheid. So over the last couple of years, we've seen growing emphasis in the Treasury and some other government departments on acknowledging urbanization, and more than that, on trying to basically capture the economic possibilities of cities and urban growth, the productivity benefits, the innovation benefits of urbanization. And we see tangible evidence of that in a new approach to local government infrastructure financing over the next 3 years. So the Treasury is very keen to try to both increase in urban infrastructure, public transport and housing would be two key elements, or human settlements, two key elements of that, but also to do that in a way that integrates these different infrastructure spending programs, right? So we're not just providing housing on the edge of the city, but we're actually integrating transport and housing with jobs and services, so we're creating more functional cities and towns rather than apartheid segregated cities and towns. All right, so key part message of not sectoral infrastructure programs, the silo approach, but a more integrated planned approach to development, to urban development. And that's really, really important. Public transport is a big theme at the moment. Increased spending on public transport, and when my colleague talked about, you know, our citizens benefiting from this infrastructure, I think that's an excellent example of how, you know, government is committed to making sure this infrastructure is relevant not just to the economy but also to ordinary people in getting to work more reliably, more quickly, more cheaply. The Treasury will work with financial institutions to expand municipal debt markets. So because of the tight public finances, the Treasury wants to get municipalities to borrow more, and it thinks that some of the key big metros in the country are not borrowing enough and have scope to borrow more, particularly for long-term infrastructure. It makes a lot of sense when you invest in long-term infrastructure to borrow and pay that back over time, right, rather than to just spend it from your rates, your ongoing income from property rates. And then finally, the Treasury is going to support the metros to do more public-private partnerships, so actually working on projects, getting the private sector involved to increase investment in the cities. So that's all consistent with, you know, what I was saying before about the general approach of government in the current difficult climate of lack of public spending. So we have to get involved the private sector. We do that by working together on practical projects. And that makes a lot of sense, it seems to me. So finally, some overarching questions to stimulate a bit of discussion. The first point is that the overall level of public spending is constrained. There isn't much scope for stimulus, and I think 95% of observers in the media would agree with that sentiment, that it's, you know, it would be nice to stimulate the economy more, but there's not a lot of wiggle room because of increasing debt, because of the generally constrained situation. Secondly, the balance between investment and consumption. The government has been talking about trying to shift from consumption spending like salaries into investment in infrastructure. We've been talking that for a long time and it struggled really to shift the balance. So I think that it remains an important challenge to shift to increase investment for future economic growth rather than current consumption. The third issue for discussion is about the quality. And again, my colleagues have talked about in education and health, you know, getting the balance right, getting the big bang for the buck, and not just focusing on the quantum of spending. And that remains a really important issue, making sure that we spend the money well and get good impact, get good social and economic outcomes from public spending that takes place. The fourth point is about the balance between national, provincial and municipal spending. There hasn't been much change, in my view, over the last decade or so. Although we are now seeing with public transport and human settlements increasing municipal spending in these areas and a continuing attempt by some parts of government to transfer responsibilities to municipalities, because it's at the municipal level that it's easier to integrate housing, transport, jobs, land use and create functional human settlements rather than to work in sectoral silos. And then finally, encouraging creativity and innovation. And I think this remains a big challenge within the public services. On the one hand, we are trying to avoid abuse of public funds, which means increasing amounts of compliance, the Auditor General, and other procedures to try and prevent, you know, abuse of public funds, that can stifle flexibility, creativity, innovation, novelty, right? Because you've continually got your hands tied behind your backs by these complicated procedures and the bureaucracy, the paperwork of the public services. So, I mean, I think that's another issue I think needs to be on the table. How do we get that right balance without being too restrictive through compliance, which drives out innovation and creativity?
Thank you very much. That's the end of the presentation. We will now take comments from honorable members. So, I'm ready to start. Honorable Professor Honorable McLaughlin. Honorable Manana, Honorable Faith. In that order.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. On page 3, that slide, I think slide 5, where you were making reference to the salaries of teachers, and indicated that the salaries look relatively small, yet the bulk of the education budget, particularly in colleges, goes to the salaries. And it does seem to me that needs a little bit of unpacking, because indeed it is true the point that you're making there, but what one would want to understand is this: what element of the teacher salary budget make it look big? Is it the more senior teachers who are paid a lot more than what we see? There are many in the system, and there are fewer younger ones who are 5 years and younger years and less. Or let's say fewer who are 5 years up to 10 years experience, and therefore and they are getting those salaries as are reflected there. Or is it because of the nature of the salary level that make which are probably skewed and therefore account for this huge budget, and therefore how do you then deal with that so that you have fair salaries going to the teachers, but also a lot more going to areas of delivery in education. That's one. Two, the on page 12, the public satisfaction on government performance. Just one area that I want to understand a bit further is the issue of affordable housing, where quite clearly people are not quite satisfied. Maybe we just at the level of the RTP housing, how do we stand in terms of satisfaction in delivery of RTP housing? And the category then of the population which are actually not satisfied is the public servants, because I know they fall within a category which does not qualify for government bond, but also don't qualify for RDP housing. And when that is mentioned, it's always the teachers and the nurses who are mentioned. Where do we stand with the police and the rest of the public service? So that we understand where the actual problem lies, and so that we, in terms of the budget, then we start looking at that. The the last clarity, Chair, that I speak is on page 13, the second last bullet, where you make reference to contestations between the traditional leadership and the civil society organization. Is the contestation around the leadership, the actual leadership style of traditional leaders? Is it around the authority of traditional leadership that is being contested? Is it areas relating to the role leadership, traditional leadership plays in terms of development in their traditional areas? What exactly is it that is the area of contestation that needs our attention?
Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. Thank you. I just ask a question. It struck me as strange that yesterday we were given a presentation by the Financial and Fiscal Commission where they showed us a graph that I can show you here. I need to show it to you, where it indicates that 77% of the basic education allowance is spent on salaries. It doesn't look quite the same as all five off. So I was just wondering why there would be a discrepancy in that. You're welcome to have a look at what they told us here. So I just, the question came up in my mind, just we're talking about the same thing, but your analysis of it seems a little different to what they told us. So if you could just maybe address me on that, I'd appreciate it. Just a few practical issues that maybe you've explained to me. On your the second slide on page 2 of the presentation, the headings there are a little confusing because where you put countries, India, USA, Brazil, Norway, etc., you show public spending on education total percentage of GDP, 3.8 is fine. The next column is percentage of government expenditure, 12.9 is fine. Then you say expenditure per student, primary percentage of GDP per capita, 9. I mean, they can't only have 10 students in that country. What is this 9% actually represent? And then again, in the next column, it says percentage of GDP per capita. Obviously, the wording is wrong, or the percentages are something else. Perhaps you could just help me out on that so that I can understand it a little better. At the bottom of that particular table as well, where you've got functionally illiterate and functionally enumerate, presumably those are not percentages of the population. The top two columns are numbers, because those scores, and the bottom two are percentages, if I'm correct.
Correct.
Thank you.
Correct. And if I may,
let's take all the comments and then allow the
then on slide 5, so I think there's a number missing. Where you say that the proportion of salaries are high, but newly qualified educators and those with less than 5 years experience earn on average 11,576. I'm sure it meant that it's supposed to be 115,000 a number per annum. Was it? Okay. I had these chairs, I'm trying to find them. The graph we were shown on page 10, the top one, that shows the drop-off in condom use. Just an observation on my part. It seems to me that we've sort of taken our foot off the gas when it comes to advertising, so the word I want to use is not quite the right word, but just bringing this to the attention of the public in general, the problem still exists. People seem to have got complacent. Because it seems like other problems solved now. And I would suggest maybe that's one of the reasons why there's been this drop off, because we haven't sort of kept on pushing it and kept on emphasizing that the problem still exists. And you can just explain to me, going back to page 9 at the top, you make the statement, the drop in condom use at last sex in 2012 when compared to 2012. It's from 08 to 2012. Sorry. Thank you. Again, it seems to be a typo. Maybe you can assist me on page 12 in the top graph. It's the second bullet point in the bottom. It says level of satisfaction to access to healthcare is up by 6% from 2011 51% to 2012 51%. But presumably it should have been 57% in 2012. Just looking at the graph, the lower graph on page 12. The second last bullet point, 51% appears twice. Doesn't look correct. In the table, the lower table on page 12, I notice if you look at the whole table, it's only in three instances that the public satisfaction level is up on 2003. All the rest are down. Maybe marginally down, but they're down. So the overall picture would be that the overall public satisfaction level has dropped, which would tend to contradict what's stated in the previous slide, that tends to give the impression that generally the public is happy with things, but given the bigger picture, it looks like they're not that happy. In fact, they've become less happy. Governance through traditional affairs on page 13. You give us a number there, you say about 15 million work. So the question is kind of, what percentage of the population are we looking at that regards the traditional way of doing things as their ruling life rather than the conventional way that those of us who sit in this room would be inclined to believe? Are we talking about a significant portion of the population? And are the grants that are being given commensurate with the size of the portion of the population we're dealing with? You say they look a little low, but I was thinking that may be the case if we're looking at the whole country, but if we're looking at it commensurate sizes, is it the same or should it still be increased? My next question was, is this situation, the traditional situation, something that is going down slowly with time? Is it reducing? Are people becoming more and more westernized, as it were, and less traditional? Is there a point in time where we're not going to have to bother with traditional leaders anymore because it's going to sort of fade away, go into the midst of history, or is it something that's going to increase perhaps? But then we should be giving it a different emphasis, I would assume, because we need to look at it. Where are we headed with this? Are we trying to encourage it, or are we trying to maintain it, or are we trying to reduce it? And then I just wondered, is there some sort of competition between the two systems? Are people sort of in a situation where they are given a choice? Either we can go the traditional way or the Western way, for want of a better word, and then have a decision to make. And if there's a traditional way that suits them better, would they choose to go that way rather than the Western way? And if it is the case, are we addressing the issue from that point of view? In other words, capacitating the traditional leadership to cope with an increasing burden on them. Just questions I had in that regard. improving rural development. Just generally, the impression I get overall is that national and provincial spheres of government are pushing the burden down onto municipalities. There seems to be an ongoing shift of trying to get the municipalities to do more, take on a larger responsibility. But we're not giving the municipalities the money to do it with. There's still stuck at the 9% of the fiscal that goes to the municipalities. On the understanding that municipalities are supposed to collect their own money and be self-sufficient to an extent, but if we're going to put on this increasing burden on them, don't we need to capacitate them more? They need to have the ability to do it. I agree that municipalities are the places where you have the greatest opportunity for integration, the greatest interaction with your community. That's where it all happens. But unless we're going to give them the money and the capability to do it, we're going to shoot ourselves in the foot, because we're going to have an ever-increasing dissatisfaction with the fact that the municipalities are not capable of providing the services, and the general increase in infrastructure and everything else that people are expecting of them. I think we may need to look at it from a slightly different point of view, that the more burden we put on them, the more we need to increase their ability to cope. It's across the board. It's not just in the question of rural development, the housing aspect as well. It's long been one of my bones of contention that water and sanitation, for example, sits at the national level, it sits at the provincial level, it sits at the municipal level, but municipalities are the ones who are supposed to provide all the water, but they're not given the resources to do it. They must rely on other departments. But whenever there's a complaint or a public protest about it, the municipality is the one who gets the problem, and not the other levels where it's actually performed. I was glad to see that on the fiscal consolidation lists that the HSRC and the FFC see the same problems. That's obviously a good indication of the fact that those are indeed the risks we're up against, and it's something that we need to concentrate on. As regards to the economy, the high government debt and the growth of debt servicing, like this correlation, we save up by 10% per annum on our servicing costs. Presumably, that's just servicing, it's not reducing the debt. I just wanted to ask, is the cost of servicing the debt comparatively on the increase? Because it was interesting to me to find out fairly recently that 90% of government debt is local. In other words, they borrow locally, not offshore. Only 10% is borrowed offshore. So the fall in the value of the rand, for example, won't affect the cost of repayment or the interest burden on those particular loans. It might affect it on the offshore ones, because the change in value of the rand. But is there a change in the amount of interest we're being charged as the debt burden goes up and as the risk of being repaid obviously increases? And if so, is there something we can do to mitigate that? I have this belief that I also expressed yesterday, that our public sector wage bill is something that's becoming an ever-increasing problem. We try to create or solve our unemployment problems with programs like EWP and CWP, which might give people work, but it doesn't get much job done. There's a very low level of productivity. For example, the EWP workers are deployed into municipalities, but they're paid by the province. The municipalities have no power over these people. They can't enforce any kind of work ethic there, because the attitude is, well, you don't pay our salaries, you don't have to do as you tell us, although that's where they're actually working. And the municipalities are very reluctant to take on the burden of administering them, because they've got better things to do, and it's not really their problem. We need to try and find some other means of sorting out this problem, in my opinion, because it's not solving the issue. It's just increasing our wage bill, and we're not getting much return on it. As with any investment, you want a return on it. If we're improving people's ability to work, that's a different story. But if we're just, in effect, giving people a handout to go and stand around in an orange overall under a tree for a day or two, it doesn't really achieve a great deal. for institutions to expand the university debt market. It's something that I find a little difficult at the moment, because in terms of the Municipal Finance Management Act, municipalities are very limited to the amount of debt they can actually incur and how they can go about incurring it. They have to get a council resolution before they incur any debts, and it's often an oddly debated thing. In councils, there's quite a lot of restriction placed on them in terms of legislation, but now we want to help them to expand the debt market. They're under a lot of pressure from the local ratepayers not to go to that group, because it obviously means that they spend more money on servicing debt and repaying loans rather than putting to use of service delivery items and so on. And it, I know in my own experience in municipalities, it's been a major problem, because the public at large don't understand how it works. They don't realize that you can't just go and spend your rates and taxes on buying a new fire engine, because you need one, because then nobody's going to have any water or electricity for a month or two because you can't pay Eskom. It's quite a complicated exercise, and I think it, I commend it, but I don't know how we're going to do it under our current constraints. Perhaps you could give me some assistance there. I like the idea of public-private partnerships, but in practice, in my experience, they're very difficult things to achieve. Everybody seems to want to control all the shots, and nobody's prepared to do anything, and to negotiate these deals is extremely difficult. Perhaps some specialized unit needs to be created that will do that sort of negotiation to facilitate these things, because at the moment they are very difficult to achieve. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me welcome the presentation from the presenters. Please, Chairperson, can they just unpack the comparison of international spending on education? I've been trying to go through it, but it's not easy, you can just unpack it. The second issue is with regards to the salaries of teachers. Here they are indicating that housing is having 67% and Eastern Cape is there as well. It's not clear to me what are the reasons really, because the population of housing is more than Eastern Cape, and it seems as if, in fact, housing was supposed to have more teachers than the other provinces, but now it seems as if just the opposite. If they can just explain to us exactly what is really happening here. Coming to the last part, the funding. Yes, indeed, there were negative reputation with regard to the people complaining that they were getting their funds very late, and it seems that this is not working for them as it is supposed to be. There is a slowdown from the budget. If they can just explain to us the reason why they are failing to administer this fund. Coming to that, when the policy of government is to promote primary health care, but seemingly we are not really moving from that direction. It seems people, they are still concerned that they need to go to hospital rather than to go to the clinic or health center. Maybe they had no reason for that. Why are they not utilizing the health center that are nearby rather than to go to the hospital? HIV and AIDS. It's scary to see that the number of people who are still infected is going up rather than to go down. And the issue of the HIV, yes, commendable that we need to have it. But it seems as if we are no longer using the ethics, the AIDS, yes, very effectively. That is why people they believe that the antiretrovirus drug is the treatment that is going to cure the disease. And that you are going to give all the people who are having 854 pounds, it is going to create no problem for the country. Coming to the maternal and child health, is one of the SDGs that we need to look at. If really what we did, I remember the Minister of Health, when he was when he attended our committee last time, he raised these issues that we're having a serious problem in South Africa, especially amongst our young mothers who don't want to go to clinic for antenatal clinic, who present themselves to not deliver. That is where the problem starts, because we notice of this a patient, and now at the end of the day is presenting cases for deliver, and there are complications thereafter. So I think we need to have more health education in regards to this project. These young mothers can attend the clinic as soon as possible.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. Obviously some of the stuff has been covered, so I'm not trying to duplicate the issues. So mostly just for clarification and a few comments. The first issue on, now I'm going to use pages if you don't mind, because some of the slides are not numbered according in my presentation. The first one I noticed with regards to the analysis at the bottom, the comparison between South Africa and Kenya. Now, the reading scores for both natural science are 495, and I see for Kenya is 543. My question is, that other one, is the 494.5 very low, and is the 543 and 557 by Kenya good? Or is that where we should be striving towards, Kenya? Or should we not be striving towards another country? Just a question. So my question is, what is it? The analysis that has been done, has that been done by your private schools, your public schools, or what is your source of that analysis? Slide number 3 has been covered. Page number 4, the issue regarding student funding in higher education, there's an amount that is given of 19.9 billion, and we know now that people have been crying that amount is inadequate for a number of reasons. Can I just ask you, you also give, the information given is 711 in higher education and 844. Do we have the split in terms of the amount spent for TVET colleges and the amount spent for higher education colleges? In other words, are we spending, is it proportional? Obviously the needs are different, so it might not be. The issue regarding this NSFAS, where many people are being made and unhappy and complaining, I do understand that some of it is bursary, some of it is loan. What are the conditions that are attached to those bursary and the loan, and perhaps, you know, some of these questions might be difficult. I'm not expecting you to know all the answers, but it's, for me, it's interesting to know that. The loan recovery, well, the recovery of the loan, that rate, is that acceptable? How much of the loan is being recovered? Because otherwise, every year you're going to ask for more, well, they're going to ask for more and more instead of using the money that has been recovered to re-issue as a loan. The health, I'm not concerned about the health budget, because it seems to me that irrespective of how much amount is given to health, the health care in this country is a disgrace. It's shocking. So I'm not so sure if the problem is with the appropriation of the health, the amount given to health, or the competence of the healthcare professionals. Because, I mean, somebody sent me a message from Mkata last night, a child is sick. The nurse gave her a blanket and said, go sleep on the floor there. The other night, my colleague was with me, Port Elizabeth. Somebody had to go, somebody had an emergency. They had taken an overdose. They go to the doctor, to the hospital. They had to wait from 8 o'clock to 2 o'clock, and they didn't see a doctor. She went home. You know, so maybe the money is not the issue. We're focusing on the wrong issues. Maybe we should be focusing on the resources, the other resources, the human resources, and maybe that's where your education of the healthcare professionals come into it. That's really where the problem is. The slide number 5. Just a comment here, just for clarification again. They talk about re-engineering of what public health care. Now, I'm hoping that the re-engineering will be for better quality service instead of, because it indicates there that it might require additional expenditure. If that is the case, then I believe that health care should be funded to whatever is needed. But I think it becomes a problem if the outcome is not acceptable. Slide number 7, page number 7, I've got here. Let me just see. Okay, this is all about the HIV. Now, I'm not an expert, but it seems as though the focus is on waiting until, I might be wrong here, until they get infected and then treating them, instead of a lot more focus and money invested in your research and your education and that sort of thing. That seems to be, because now we're more looking at the counts and you know, which obviously, at the end of the day, you're just going to have more people on ARVs instead of, you know, less people. And so maybe one should look at the allocation of the resources in the correct area. Slide number 12. Page number 12. Yeah, this table, it's an interesting table here. Just a comment on it. It's the fact. So you obviously didn't have an answer here. But what is interesting is that if I look at electricity, water sanitation, and maybe those two, clearly, I mean, more people have been provided with electricity, water sanitation, but it's gone down. It's just strange. It's ironic that it happened. So it's just a comment on that. And again, as my colleague pointed out, is that only two of them seem to have gone up over time, which it shouldn't be the case. It should be more. So that's just a comment. I don't expect any comment from your side. And then slide page number 18. Page number 18, I'm nearly done, Honorable Chairperson. I'm nearly done. Ooh, this is one that I haven't received an answer yet. I've asked some people. This is the last bullet point in the top slide on page 18. These non-core assets that the Minister spoke about, property. Has anybody, including the Minister, identified those non-core assets and the value of those non-core assets? Because we know what we need to fund the state-owned entities, but do we know how much what the value of the total value of the non-core assets that we have available for disposal? That's just a question. And then my last one on slide number 19, Honourable Chairperson, is this issue of your local, your equitable share. Now, the 9%, we know 9% is issued to local government. We know the fact that it's not, they're not coping, and there could be a number of reasons. They're not collecting what the revenue they should be in terms of rates. But they are also, it might also not be enough, the 9%. So I would like to know, what could that be increased? What's your comment on that? Or is it, am I making a statement that is not justifiable? Or, and then that split of the 9%, because obviously I don't believe that all the provinces should get an equal share of that 9% because they have different needs. So, and I've seen a formula, and what was interesting about the formula is that for whatever reason, KZN gets most of it. Now, I'm hoping it's not for the reason that some people are thinking. Thank you. Honorable Chairperson.
Thank you. Perhaps we should allow them to respond, then we can do another follow-up. You want to come now? After, okay. Maybe if you can also comment briefly on some of the government interventions on the economy, around growing the economy, creating jobs, like extended public work programs, the jobs fund, what's the view of the council on these interventions, creation of Department of Small Businesses, incentives from DTI, are these things working? Will they assist going forward? Please share your views with us on that. Let me allow you to respond, and then we'll come back again to take another round.
Okay, thanks, Chair. Perhaps for experience, maybe if we could just go through from the beginning and try as quickly as possible. So we will start with Linda.
Thank you, colleagues. There are a few questions about the data and the information, and that's always tricky in a presentation like this. We don't want to drown you with all the detail, but it does make a significant difference. For example, we've given you figures for the proportion of teachers of spending on teacher salaries for 2014, and the Financial and Fiscal Commission is the 2015-16 data. So that's where we always look at the years for which the data is presented. Then to come to the international comparison, there were a number of questions on that slide, and I can take them together because they're all related, I think. The question is, there's four columns. So the first one is saying, if India, for example, is spending 20 million on education, what is that as a proportion of India's GDP? The second column is saying what proportion is of that 20 million is this of total government expenditure. So how much is government expending on education relative to health or transport? Now the third one gets a little bit more complicated because it's saying if India is spending 20,000 rand per year on one pupil, what proportion is that of the GDP per person, per capita? So it is correct what it says here. So if we're evaluating our GDP per capita as 1,000 and we're spending 20,000 per pupil, well, I'm not giving the right numbers and proportions, but are you with me? So it's looking for E for a person. So those are also percentages, so it's 9%, 26%, and so on. And what you'll see, interestingly, then if you compare in the UK, 6% of GDP is spent on education, but it's 26% per capita. Okay, so when you're looking at it per person, it's being used more effectively
as opposed to, say, India or even South Africa. And similarly, and then the two columns, one is for primary schooling and the other is for secondary schooling. So often we find that in Africa, for example, primary schooling is more effective than secondary schooling, which is critical for economic development. And then the comparison between South Africa and Kenya, I should have said the higher the score, the better. I don't have the full set of results here to compare, but why we selected Kenya to compare is, well, firstly, this is a Southern African study, but often when we present results, one tends to use developed economies as the comparator, and we critique for that, and we are moving more and more to compare with BRICS countries and with African countries. So that explains that one. Then there was a very interesting, that data is also related to public schools. Then there is also a very interesting question on the next slide about the allocation of teachers' salaries, and the point was made that it needs unpacking, and a number of excellent questions were raised. Now, this is something we would like to research further because it's really becoming clear to us through preparing here that we're onto something interesting. That's a complex issue that could add a lot of value if we're looking at efficiency and effectiveness. But what you are pointing to is that Gauteng, in fact, I just, while I was looking at this example, I found a statement in this Financial and Fiscal Commission which points to the problems caused by lack of compliance, lack of institutional capacity, and corruption. And I'm pretty sure that if we look at the way education is being managed and administered in those two provinces, we would find that those factors are accounting for the fact that you're having more teachers in the Eastern Cape that are less effective, whereas Gauteng has stronger institutional capacity and perhaps better compliance. I won't make any judgments on corruption, but they have identified the high proportion of spend on teacher salary as an issue and then significantly put in place efforts to increase the proportion and to spend on other aspects. And we do have evidence on how that happened. And the key point we're making is that, you know, the questions were asked about the balance between senior and junior teachers, and that's something to really look into more systematically, because we do need to attract young people into teaching. There have been very ambitious targets set to grow the teaching profession over the next 10 years, and there's been a lot set aside in bursary programs and a dedicated stream in NIFSAS. So we do need to look at that in terms of the quality of teaching. And then there were a number of questions about NIFSAS, and those who are interested, there have been one or two key reports over the last few months that we have forward to you on that. The split between TVET and higher education, there's far more spent on higher education because the TVET was only introduced about 3 or 4 years ago. And we also have to raise questions, particularly in the TVET, about pass rates and throughput and the effectiveness of that spend. And then the question of the recovery rate is the thorny issue. I don't have the exact figures at my fingertips, but that is one of the main problems, is the administrative systems that to recover are themselves very expensive to run. And that's where we again have a problem of institutional capacity and compliance. And particularly in this band, there have been numerous instances reported, and DHET is struggling with issues related to corruption within universities and within institutions in the the management of the nurses. Thank you.
Regarding health,
there were three questions. And they all refer or can be conceptualized in the word cross-refer. And that refers to a primary healthcare clinic or equivalent having a functional system that is high up the chain or across the chain to a district hospital, to an academic hospital. And that very often is a problem, which is why it's not just that people present late themselves. The example specifically for the question, access is one problem, but the people themselves is also a problem. So education is crucially important, just like the slide, I think slide 7, I think I put up, refers to the re-engineering, which is exactly what the other honorable member referred to. If re-engineering means that type of service is going to get there, then all money must go there in order to have a better service, and I couldn't agree with that more. The re-engineering itself, it's not just only physical, it's in terms of capacity at that level. At the moment, we don't have enough capacity at that level. For instance, we don't have, it has been very difficult to find gynecologists to work at that level and take care of a particular area, which means we'll see a lot more, and it will be, the clinic will be much more functional than what it is at the moment. So that is the main issue, but perhaps we must take the comment that the health system is a disgrace, and I will not defend or disagree with it. But we do have some data that we must bear in mind, national data, 2012, that actually, in simple terms, if you have two categories, very good and good, and if you have two sectors, the public and the private sector, in excess of 80% of people will say the service is good if you are in the public sector, as opposed to the private sector, the public, the people say 90%, more than 90% of people say it's good. In other words, the private sector is better. That doesn't mean that 80% is not good. It just means that it's not as good as the private. And this is not a defense. Because in relation to the point that was raised, attitudes and so forth, that is one of the points where the public sector is actually the worst. And I had a slide like that, which we did not include in the end because it referred to something very specific. Waiting times, which includes all the aspects that were covered, are actually very bad. Not bad, very bad in the public sector. And there is a huge difference between the public sector and the private sector. And that is probably what we read in the papers. Are there exceptions? No, I don't want to name them exceptions because for the person that is affected is real life day experience. So you cannot say it's a small percentage. I don't think that's the way to go because it's not as easy as that. But it's something that we need to improve on. And with regard to the young mothers, and that is the last point of the three that were made. You know, yes, education is, but we have to focus that education. And one of the emerging things that we spoke about already is the first 1,000 days of life. Doesn't go just about breastfeeding or all these things are important, but we have to pay additional attention to care. We have to enable young mothers to know how to care. And caring
competitiveness. And from the point of view of investment, that is where this country or our country needs to invest in early in life. Determines disease patterns in the future, and I can go on, but that's another question. Thank you, Jeff. I'll give other additional information if necessary. Thanks.
Okay, continuing on HIV AIDS, thanks for the comments and observations, Matt. I just need to clarify on one issue. Yes, I did emphasize that there were still new infections happening. Perhaps I should have contextualized from where we are coming from. We are doing well. There has been a decline in the levels of new infections compared to three, 4, 5 years ago. So overall, there has been a decline nationally in the number of new infections. I was just trying to recall the number which we used to cite in terms of daily infection rate, but currently, because it's still 1,000 a day estimated, we say that is still too high. Right? So please contextualize it that way, particularly amongst young people, which is understandable. Among young people, we really have been making inroads. And it is foreseeable by 2030 we might end up having an AIDS-free youth. But remember, those who are already infected will still be on treatment if they are still alive in 2030. So that's one clarification. The second one is an observation made about that perhaps we are not doing as much on prevention as we used to. Honorable member talked about no adverts. Really, if you drive around Cape Town, you hardly see any. And that is true. It's okay, I understand how Gauteng has started a campaign, and KZN also have provincial ones, but they are no longer national campaigns. No, we used to all see Love Life billboards, particularly those of us who are slightly older. They didn't even understand what these billboards were saying, but it seems they were really targeting young people who appreciated what they were saying. So indeed, what has happened over the past 5 years in particular is that we seem to have shifted our focus onto treatment so much that we have forgotten that we need to continue to prevent new infections. So we can do a wonderful job with treatment, but if there are still new infections, it really just compounds the problem. So the solution is really to maintain that balance. We need to do as well and even better with treatment, but make sure we go back to the basics, head ABC. Basically, that's what we need to do. Thank you. Tony?
Thank you very much. This is a quick response on the national, on the state cap survey. We're taking a national agenda sample and it's stratified by towns, urban, rural, race, and gender. And it looks at African citizens from 16 years and older. There's no specific focus on who should be on public servants. So there's no targeting of specific public servants. So there are other studies that we are obviously involved in with the Department of Public Service and Administration on satisfaction surveys. We're quite open to be called with another time to come and explain some of that to this portfolio, to this appropriation committee. On the whole question of RDP houses, I think it's suffice to say that the satisfaction is around housing and access to housing. And it's also about being able to afford, either from getting private investors to help with that, or to make sure that people get loans. But the long and short of this is that human testimonies will probably tell you that there are certain areas where the banks are needing to relook at how it actually targets subsidization for those areas. But also, on the other hand, is that there are also other income thresholds where a person would not get a bond from a bank. So there's a number of things that needs to be done. And in fact, my view is simply that there's a greater need for the state to play a much more interventionist role in the human settlements, housing provision market. And the state is probably the best place to do that. Obviously, with attracting support from the private sector. There are interventions around social housing and also helping to cushion support for on the income side for public servants. But I guess if you interact with human settlement, they will give you a much more greater sense of the different interventions done by the different public entities. And you will probably have a greater sense as to what works and what doesn't work within that particular environment. On the traditional issues that the honourable members raised, I guess you're probably not referring to the Western way, you're probably referring to our constitutional way, honourable members, just to help you on that. Because it's about the Constitution boarding where some of these things come, because our Constitution provides quite a lot of a number of ideas. So I think the key question is not about either or, it's about how do we see the tension of an intersect between what the constitutional governance system requires and its reflection at the municipal level or local level and relative to the traditional systems. And how those two intersect with each other. More specifically, it's essentially also about who leads the development within a particular area and what's the nature of consultation or no consultation that needs to take place and to what extent is Africa's involved in that. So our view is that with a focus on traditional affairs as opposed to the traditional department, consumer affairs department, there's now a renewed focus on bringing to bear the traditional system into the constitutional governance arrangement of the country. I think it's an important activity which probably lends itself to potential modernization of systems and of structures and of a range of practices within those geographical areas, which is quite important, but also lends itself to potentially a new way of traditional municipal authority, and I'm reminded that somebody, one of the intellectuals at Witt told me 2 days ago that from the time of Shaka, what has happened is that if you come into a particular area, you need to be presented to the traditional affairs, to the Nduna and chieftainship, and that as a person that's foreign to that area, you can't just come in and be part of a particular activity. There's a particular traditional process of this. Now that in itself finds tensions with some part of our constitution, especially the right to movement, freedom of association. Yes. So there's a need to think about that so that we build a system that has understanding from the rest of society that links with our constitutional question. On the issue of municipalities with regard to you raised the matter about the rural, urban, and the 15 million distribution. I don't have the type of data that you require, but it's important to know that the sorts of functions to municipalities or the sorts of functions to national in many ways, it's got to do with the capacities that you correctly raise. But we, when you talk about capacity, we always seem to refer to staff. In reality, it's less about the staff, but more about the fiscal capacity, the economic capabilities and potential of a particular area, but also the political, social network, of operational and networks, if you like, and the schedule of, and that needs to be looked at in terms of that, because if you're not going to if you're not going to do it properly and correctly, we're going to contribute in different ways to continuous impoverishment of certain geographical spaces and certain areas. Hence, in some instances, transfer comes from national and immediately goes to pay. I know I'm increasing, it immediately goes to pay ESCOM account. So in reality, there's nothing sitting in the municipality. So there's a need to look at that, and probably the demarcation issue can be resolved in a different way. There's a fiscal question that needs to be resolved, and taxation issues that needs to be looked at. But I think it's also what one wants to remind ourselves continuously, the scheduling of competencies, the scheduling of functions. The Constitution is rather clear on some of these things. In some instances, there's initial functions. But I think that there is a move internationally, and Ivan also managed to tell you in part that internationally and also domestically to create greater urban areas, the big metros. So there is a big urbanization, city government approach has been followed, and hopefully over the next, before the local government elections announcement, we'll have a greater sense of how South Africa look at the local, at the city governance level. And that's where greater functions is gonna, probably going to go, and in a way it's also going to create further squeeze in the hourglass, because province is sitting that squeeze of the hourglass in terms of that particular responsibility. But I think when you look at that, my view would be is to look at finance follow function. Either within the municipality in terms of greater taxing revenue generation responsibility, or where a national provides a greater share of the fiscus to city for urban areas. So that's a critical conversation I would see. So there are not the politics of it, but the technical part of it. Because that's where it matters. So that's basically you raised the issue on improved public service. I think the question that my colleague Glenda Dr. Cruz mentioned, it is about reviewing institutional policy of the public service, because it's got quite a mirrored, complex infrastructure. But it's also about a need, and I raised this at another occasion two years ago, there's a need to influence how the education, training, and professional development of public service. Because it's an assumption that if you have a degree, that you're a public servant. I can tell you it's not the case at all, because you don't train people to be public servants. You train people to get a degree or a particular qualification. And there's no influence as to what type of public servant that you require. So it's unfair for you or your colleagues to say, we got lazy public servants, we got incompetent public servants. In fact, nobody knows what type of public servant we want. We just know that we want people to deliver good service, but we've never able to characterize. We've got a battle plan, which says something about being nice, but it doesn't say what type of real competence is required to push capabilities within the state, but also to make sure that the public service is responsive to the economy and to its citizens. The other thing that you raised was so there's a need to look at this professionalization issue of the public service or depolarization of the civil service. And I think we're not having the right debate around those questions, and it gets merged by it's enveloped in ideological, political party understanding of deployment. I think we need to have grapple with that, because there is a need to reform the public service, because you have a hotlatch of 14, 16 or 18, depending who you are, where you lived from 20 years ago, in the Bantustan or in the apartheid South Africa or in the New South Africa, you will know what either 16 or 14 or 16 or 18 governments that we used to have, and these things were thrown back, and then there was overlay of people within the democratic system that came into the service. So we haven't really done a total transformation of the South African civil service or the public service. And that's going to give you the capacity that you want. That you're crying for. So I'm suggesting that there is a need to have a real dialogue. But what very often happens is that when you have these conversations, the dialogue on public service and capable professional public service, who talks? It's either your colleagues, the politician, and the public service. It is not opening your eyes to picking a space. So if they reproduce, continue to solve the interests of the United States. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. Quite a few questions. I want to first answer the question about satisfaction with housing that the Honourable Member asked. I think the answer would vary depending on whether the person is occupying an RDP house, whether the person has got a free house and is highly satisfied, by and large, as against everybody else. And I think that's extremely important for the policy, in that basically we have had a rather narrow housing policy, restricted by and large to building people RDP housing. And I think the message is we need a wider range of housing responses for people in different circumstances. So it's not restricted to people below 3,500 rand. We've got to help a larger group of society in different ways, with smaller support for rental and for people to buy and so on. And we haven't been doing enough. We haven't been creative enough with our housing policy. There was a number of questions from yourself, Honourable Member, about the first one about shifting the burden onto municipalities without the funding. And I think that's quite right, and we do need to shift resources in line with responsibilities. I should say that a couple of points about this, though. The first one is the differentiated approach, I think, is a very important idea, that the capacity varies in different places. And so the responsibilities should also differ. If the metros are more capacitated than the rural municipalities, they should have more responsibility. And they also, some of them can also raise more funding locally than others, right? So I think that the balance of national funding and locally generated funding is quite important for accountability and the health of democracy. We don't want our municipalities being completely dependent on transfers from the center. They must also raise some. On the debt, high government debt, and whether the servicing is, we're paying more in terms of the costs of servicing, I'm not actually sure what the response is. I don't think it's changed very much, although, having said that, we know that our ratings have declined, the Fitch, the Standard & Poor's, and that probably affects the rate for new bonds, for new borrowing by government. So it might have gone up a bit as a result of that. Expand the public works program. I think it's a couple of points. Firstly, people are very low paid on public works program. You know, there are no social grants for adults. All right, so this in some ways is a useful function, even if, you know, I hesitate to say they're not doing very much. Of course, you want them to be productive. You want them to be acquiring skills. You want them to be doing useful things. And you're quite right that you want to get the responsibility in line with who's paying for them, so that there's an incentive to improve the performance of these programs. The best program, in my limited understanding, is the community works program, right, where it's locally based, where communities have some control over it, not these massive programs which are, you know, one suspects not very effective, doing useful work at the local level, more flexibility in what they can do, market gardens, social care, all sorts of useful social functions. Municipal debt, I'm sure that is a borrowing is difficult, and maybe we need to look at the rules again to try and simplify it, to make it easier for municipalities to borrow. They'll have to borrow more over time given constrained government funding, so we need to make it easier for them, I suppose. on PPPs, very hard. You're quite right. The legislation makes it very difficult to negotiate PPPs. There is a unit in Treasury, I'm not sure whether you're aware, that specializes in PPPs, but they focus on the very big projects. And maybe the message should be that they need to broaden their scope and to work on some other kinds of schemes. And certainly the rules need, I think the rules need to be made simpler, because it could take 3 or 4 years apparently to negotiate a PPP, which is crazy. You were asking about the quantification of non-core assets in state entities. Well, I'm sure the entities themselves know what assets they're sitting on. They tend to be quite jealous about them. The only thing I know about really is the property side of it. The Transnet, for example, sit on huge property assets and are very reluctant to release them, because this helps their balance sheet, it helps them with their borrowing, right? But it undermines what we were talking about a bit before about the urban integration. They're sitting on vacant sites, 10, 15, 20 years in prime location. They're sitting on vacant land, which we need for housing. And so we need to, government needs to be a bit tougher, I think, on these entities and to meet other purposes, you know, not just funding, but also to meet social purposes, to get rid of things that they are withholding and undermining coherent urban development by taking a narrow kind of accountancy approach to their assets. And your other final point to me was about the 9% and whether we should be increasing the resources. I tend to feel that we should be. Our 9% is low by international standards. Most other countries, you know, give more money to municipalities. It obviously got to be done quite slowly to build up capacity at the same time. Otherwise, you're going to create problems if it happens too quickly. I don't think KZN does get a disproportionate share. There's some gossip about it getting a better share of the freeway spending in recent years. And if you do look at Ekwini, it does have has had some major freeway projects in recent years. But the bulk of the funding is allocated to a formula, right? Which is, I think there's not a lot of discretion about that. And then the chair asked some very tough questions about, are these major industrial programs and policies and economic job creation, jobs fund and so on, are they working? Frankly, I don't really know the answer. I think we should have more evaluation of these programs, and I think that's probably your job to ask, to see the evidence. Are they being evaluated? Are they proving cost effective? My gut feeling is that it's very mixed. Some of them are proving effective and others less so, depending on the caliber of the people responsible, and depending on their vigilance in relation to what they're doing. I do know anecdotally that some schemes like the business process outsourcing grants, call centers, have been very effective at attracting foreign investment in call centers. We've done very well in that respect in recent years in South Africa, so I think that's been a good incentive. The motor industry one, there's quite a lot of controversy about, you know, whether we've certainly increased investment in automobiles. You know, it's very expensive, but we've done well compared with many countries on in the car industry. And I think in some cases it actually takes time to see whether it's really cost effective, right? Because we want to see the suppliers now. We want to see the second round multiplier effects from these big assembly plants. So that will take time to really see whether it's been cost effective. But at face value, it looks like it has had a big impact, but it's also cost a lot of money.
Okay, I think let's take the last round of comments, starting with Honorable Shopee Stole, Honorable Mazoka. Anyone else can come back? Honorable Kolaza. Okay, those two, and then we will take comments. Honorable Shopee Stole, let's start with you.
Thank you, Chairperson, for the opportunity. I just want to thank the presenter most profoundly from the bottom of my heart, because I think you are not the department that must answer questions. You are our advisor. And as I'm sitting here, I think I'm more clever when the department come out, I know what to ask them. But more global, you know, I never suspected any time of my life of asking Transnet and Eskom about their asset registers and the properties that they own, because I think that is key to economic development. Mm. And if you had not come here today, that question would still not be asked by myself for the next 2 years. So thank you very much for that one. And if you, by any accident or fortune, have any record of the assets they hold, asset register or balance sheet, can you please let me get one of them? And also, somebody talked about reports of the of maybe two reports of you know, this barbaric thing, you know, what do you call it? I'm not an educationist, I don't know much about those things. But my sister is helping me. I need those reports. And when you were presenting, you know, sorry I came late, I didn't know your name. Daniel, I was thinking, is this man a lawyer? That is what was going through my mind. Maybe a prospective judge. Yeah, because you know, I like this debate in South Africa of the independence of the judiciary. Very much on everybody's. But people never talk about the capacity and power to make law of ourselves. Our laws are always challenged left, right, and center. And nobody comes on our side. I'm just asking you to just look at that one. Because I feel the Constitution empowers us to make the law. And I think that is our job, not the job of the judge. But sometimes I just feel maybe they are encroaching on our responsibility. And I'm saying it in a more serious way. I was thinking about it even today when I was coming to work. But, you know, I don't know much about law, and I don't know how to tackle these guys. They are so educated. for instance, when I was reading the finding emerging from research, they say most agree that courts should be independent and play a role in constitutional transformation. But courts cannot implement their own judgment. Legislature and the executive must comply. I fully agree with that, but I would have loved it very much if you have said, and all other institutions, because we have got an instance where a certain judge Gebhard made a judgment, and the public protector went all out to say that is cut and paste, and I thought that was interfering with the independence of the judiciary, and everybody was silent. But if it was sent by me or the chairperson, who up to date would be talking about it? So I would like to say that when I heard that, I thought the public protector was interfering with the independence of the judiciary, because I thought as a lawyer she should know that if she's not satisfied she can appeal peace. But not say that, because I'm worried about the effect on the, you know, in the rural areas, we hold her in very high esteem. And if she says something, the ordinary men and women are going to say the judges in South Africa are just a bunch of nonsense, and we have a lot of chaos. And that is very, very, very undesirable in our country. we come into the economy. Is that what that is? Coming to the economy, I really like the fact that municipalities are going to be assisted to be able to borrow more so that they can do more. And I think the question of their accountability is our daily. I think as this committee we need to make sure that they account. We can't stop them from receiving more money so that we can do less work. We need to give them more money and hold them to account on their in-year spending. I think that is the responsibility of ourselves. That is why we exist too. So we will deal with that one when they don't do what we want them to do. The last one. No, I remember the last one. Thank you.
Thanks, Honorable.
No, thanks, Honorable Chair. Thanks to the presenter. I think I'm covered on the first one on the report of the NSFAD because it's really a concern. We really need a report that has come out today so that we can look at the challenges, because in all the high institutions of learning, we see students plateauing. They are not dead, they are dead. And we don't know whether it is a shortage of money or the problem of administering these student funds. And the other issue that I need more clarity. I agree with Mr. Blackie to say that we don't really as a country know what type of civil servants we are looking for. We keep on saying that no, they are not the right ones, but we don't know because we have never sit down and then indicate. I think that's why FFC said that they need a budget to do the research on the skills that is required by the council when they're doing their presentation and the relevant skills for civil servants going forward. But there is something that I want to check on the economy. Is this a 45% on the high government debt still in line or still acceptable? That we can go up to 45% of the GDP for servicing the debt, because I can see that it's growing up by 10%. You know, it's a challenge really that one is seeing, but one is not sure whether are we still within the benchmark that is required on this amount. The other thing that was raised is the issue or no, the clarity, better clarity on this affordable housing. Because we are talking about government performance. Affordable housing, is it the responsibility of the government alone? Affordable housing. Because to me it's something like, as I'm working, I go to the bank, there are categories of housing, low, medium, high, you know. Why here do we only target to say government performance, satisfaction or dissatisfaction on the survey about this thing, affordable housing? Maybe to unpack what we mean by affordable housing. I had Professor Etirog try to deal with it, to say that the police and so on, but I'm still not clear to say if you are talking about government performance on the service delivery and the satisfaction of the public, how do we take affordable housing and say zoom to the competence of government alone and so on? I think my colleague did ask whether this affordable housing, are we talking about the civil servants, especially nurses, teachers and so on, or does it include low-cost housing? What are the people saying about low-cost housing? We are being told more than 3 million housing has been delivered on the low-cost housing. Is this inclusive on this one, the satisfaction that is being the satisfaction by the public on the affordable housing here, because it includes low-cost housing. The other thing is the issue of the seemingly, like we are saying, local government is doing the unfunded mandate, you know, the way we are saying, but I'm not sure whether Mr. Platis was just confirming that when he was saying that, no, the challenge is that when the grant goes to the municipality just pay Eskom for electricity and they remain poor as they were. I'm not sure because my understanding of the grant, we have got direct and indirect grants, and all these grants are conditional. They are designated for a specific job to be done. I don't know how can those particular grants just being go and pay the debt or buy with it, because they are conditional grants that are being taken down. But maybe if I can get a clarity, maybe I did not hear well what is happening around those particular issues. And also on the issue of EPWP, I don't know whether the way we understand EPWP is not just a separate program or project that are being funded, by nationally, and but the local government must do the work. My understanding of the EPWP is the fact that the government took a decision to say that because of the challenges that we are facing of unemployment and for the people to put something on the table to eat, they came up with this concept of EPWP. And on this EPWP, people must be trained to get the skills. Secondly, they must get that key job so that they can put something on the table. That is the understanding. But how do you go about on this EPWP is the fact that on the project, local government, let me say there is an infrastructure development, it's a local government level. The government said, don't only use the machine. You must have a component of labor intensive so that you draw people to have jobs. It's not like to say that it's some a man on top say, do it, but the money is with us. In it, there are EPWPs happening at a local level, provincial and national level. That is the understanding of the EPWP. It's not something that is something that government or national government just come to say, local government, do this, and then the money remains there. What the government say, to whatever you are doing in your project, there must be a component of labor intensive so that you address the issue of unemployment and people have something to put on the table. I don't think the interpretation is correct. It's like to say that the local government just do it and the national is staying with money. No, you do it to your own project. But what you get in return is incentive grant, because they are promoting each and every sphere to create jobs through EPWP. That's why they get incentive grant. Those incentive grants, they only give to those municipalities or institutions that are in a position to create a job or have that EPWP or that component of labor intensive. That is the understanding.
Okay,
that's all.
Just one comment on the graph on page 10 graph. I'm just wondering, Chair, whether perhaps the methods of communication, particularly to the younger generation, needs to be really visited. Particularly because I know that young people are not so much interested anymore in TV and radio and print media. Where you almost on a daily basis you see these adverts on issues related to how
we should curb the increase of HIV infection.
It then calls upon us to look at social media, which is a lot more accessible to younger people. But just if we work that way, what are the budgetary implications and what role can the service providers play as part of their social responsibility to their clients? I think that's an issue that we must perhaps look into. I'm not saying we need an answer now, Chairperson. I'm just saying, can we revisit our strategy and how access the different sectors of the population so that we deal with this issue? Indeed, we are pleased that the decline of infection is hindered, but 1,000 per day is just too many. We should reach out to those. And perhaps social media must begin to be part of the forum. Thank you.
Thanks, Honorable Chairperson. It's a quick one. I get concerned when a question asked by my colleague about what the acceptable level of debt is and the figure of 45% was mentioned and we got a positive response. Should it not, doesn't it depend on a number of factors? You know, not just a figure of 45, because I believe that some other countries have more than 60, 70. Shouldn't it depend on the cost of the debt, on the source of the debt, whether it's local or whether it's foreign, that sort of thing? So it can't just be a yes or a no. That's just my opinion. And I get concerned when you say yes, 45% is acceptable. Thank you.
Okay. Let's get the response.
Okay. Most of the questions were either to Dan or Ivan.
Yeah.
Could you?
Okay.
Either one of you. Why don't you get?
The quick issue was about the transfers and the immediate offsetting of transfers against debt and also operational requirements of the municipality. You're correct to say that, although you know that conditional grants get certain conditions. But you also must realize that even if conditional grants set those conditions, there is sometimes the greatest amount of funds that comes into the municipal PT is that conditional grant. I mean, there's a need to offset payments so that at least the municipality gets going. So there are municipalities in the country, that's why there's an investigation into the economic and fiscal viability of certain municipalities. And then there's a study being done to be able to see exactly which municipalities need to be rearranged, to be able to in a way, shift the load of maintaining those municipalities to bigger other municipalities in the country. So, if you look at the performance of conditional grants, and it's not a critique against the municipalities, but it's more an issue of a consideration of how do we establish the institutional arrangements with regard to the fiscus, so that we don't have municipalities in the country who are economically and fiscally unviable in terms of their existence. That's the critical thing that needs to be looked at. In fact, there are municipalities in the country, especially in the rural areas, honourable member, where the only fund that comes into their, substantially coming into their coffers, is the conditional grant and the total safe fund allocation. Now, clearly, out of that, and if the understanding is that 55% of municipal funds gets raised through their own taxes, and the rest of the 45% gets raised is a transfer from national government, then it must suggest something about that there needs to be a reconfiguration of our municipalities in order for the municipal government or the city government or whatever it's called to respond to each particular. It's not there. So So we do have in many instances where the performance of this grant, the performance of the systems within the municipalities are not able to respond to the needs of communities and for movement of people. Because other things also drive movement of people from one area to another area because of the lack of capacity within a particular municipality, rural and very rural areas in particular. You'll find a number of them in the old bunkers, the provinces where there's a configuration partly of the old bunkers. You'll find it because of a lack of fiscal capacity. And there's a need to look at that.
It's a binding model.
Yeah, indeed.
Funding model.
But you see, there's also, at the one end of the funding model, there's also, because of the constitutional requirements and also the fiscal arrangements, municipalities relative to provinces. Remember, provinces raise around between 3 and 5% of provincial funds get raised by themselves. So 95% of the money is a national transfer, either because of the constitutional grant. When it comes to municipalities, and sometimes you buy your independence to a greater extent. So when it comes to municipalities, a lion's share of it is funded by raised themselves. In fact, part of the issues that is probably interesting matter is that where does infrastructure development going in some of those disciplined main metros? If you look at the performance of conditional grants, you will see that certain cities prefer to go and get and do the borrowing instead of utilizing some part of the conditional grants. So that the greater mix of funds be able to help the investment going in particular cities. But it is about the fiscal, but moreover it's also about the competency, finance for the function. So my colleague Ivan is correct that there has to be a differential approach. We have a system where one size fits all. And there's clearly now, after 20 years, a need to relook at how the system is put together. And it's not a criticism against anybody. It's basically the reality of what needs to be done. We need to respond to these areas. I think they're not the only one.
Okay, I'll try and keep these answers brief. The first point about, it was more of a comment than a question, but I'd just like to point out that the Housing Development Agency had been trying to do a study of land ownership by different state entities, so you might want to speak to them about what they have found, because that's their responsibility, to try and persuade Transnet and Eskom and Public Works and everybody else to transfer their land to the municipalities and so on. So that would be worth following up, I think. They found it difficult, in summary, but they have made some progress. Municipal borrowing and holding them to account, I think the accountability needs to be joint. So for locally raised property taxes, they need to account to their ratepayers, to their citizens in each municipality. For national transfers, they need to account to yourselves and to Treasury and to national taxpayers. So some way of joint accountability needs to be important. We've quite a lot of discussion about the debt issue, all right, and 45% and so on. I mean, just a few points about this. I'm not really a macroeconomist, so I'm a bit of an amateur, but we are paying $126 billion this year, $126 billion in debt payments, okay? That's a lot of money. It could be spent on education, on building roads, building houses, public transport. So it's a lot of money. Don't think we should underestimate it. I agree it depends on the rate and who we're paying it to, etc. Japan is over 100%, right? So, and that's the extreme. I'm not saying that that's good or bad, but that's the extreme. I mean, I think my bottom line judgment is that it depends on the future. Right? If the economy is going to pick up quite quickly, then it's sustainable because we can repay it with growth, faster growth. But if the economy is going to stay at 2%, then it's going to be a big debt, a burden around our necks, you know. And there are actually, the commentators are very mixed about their views on where this is going, what the trajectory is. Some are saying it's going to go over 50%. The Treasury itself says it's going to stay at about 45 or 44%. That's what National Treasury says. But they're making some assumptions about growth picking up to 3%, 4%. And they, you know, fingers crossed, but you know, no guarantees about that. Then there was a question about affordable housing and this survey. Let me just point out, the survey is a sample of 5,000 people, I think it is, around the whole country. So it's quite a small survey. It's everybody's, all right? It's all their views about affordable housing. Okay, it includes some RDP recipients. Most people will not be recipients. So those people who are not recipients will feel rather negative. They will have missed out, right? Some people have been given an asset of up to 250,000 rand it's costing at the moment, right, to build RDP houses. 300,000, I've heard some figures somewhere. So some other people are resentful that they're not getting this free giveaway. And I think the policy should be more, should meet a wider range of people, not just, you know, the group that benefit at the moment. And there have been around 3 million. Okay, so then there were your questions about conditional capital grants. It seems to me that there's a difference between the conditional capital grants for electricity, transport, housing, and the equitable share. The equitable share is more flexible for municipalities to spend it. They have more discretion. All right, and so maybe that's an issue. Are they using it in the right way? Yeah. And the final point about the expanded public works scheme. I agree that there are very important rules about what it needs to be used for. The intention is to give training to incentivize job creation. Absolutely right, and that's very, very important. But I think the it's mixed. The kind of experience is quite mixed in their ability to do that. So you know, you hear really good schemes working for fire. Fires in Cape Town in March. You know, they were put out by most people working on expanded public work schemes, doing a really good job, very committed, very skilled, putting very brave. And then road programs, road building programs, also very good practice. But then you also hear stories of you know, less effective practice where they're not doing such a good job, basically. So I don't know how much monitoring and evaluation goes on of that scheme. I'm not really an expert on it, but I think that's the kind of question we need to ask. Is it being monitored and evaluated carefully to ensure that good practice is followed everywhere?
Thanks, Chair. Just a couple of comments. The first one is with regard to social media, which I'm sure has application across, you know, everything we do in life these days. But your comment is taken. There are initiatives to use social media. They term it e-health. And basically people are trying out different ways of using that. And it's not only limited to HIV, it applies to everything. So thanks for that suggestion. Hopefully someday it will find use in the fight against HIV. But just from our side to say we have heard about the request for reports to share that we have. I just wanted to mention, I think now the Auditor General does include looking at assets of organizations which they audit. I was just thinking aloud, perhaps they might have the information available to us much quicker. Just a thought. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. I remember the one that I had forgotten is to Professor Churok. You know, as you were speaking, I was just thinking of our last interview of a parliament, and I thought maybe one day you would like to come and do it to us in this committee, because I think it would be very useful on spatial development.
cyclic approach of the previous ministers and the conservative approach of the present minister. What would you advise? What would you advise? And you know, because I would ask you to maybe do some research on the amount, the unspent amount in the department. Because I can't put my finger on something, but I've got a feeling that we are not short of funds as a country. Maybe for the next 3 years, we are not, definitely not short of funds. Because every year there are funds not spent. Because I'm just imagining myself as a mother in the womb. You cannot say we are starving when meal is finished, when you still have rice and stamp and beans. You know, it means you just choose to eat back, but it doesn't mean you have reached the starvation point yet. If we can have a research of the unspent funds, maybe for the last 3 years, how much, so that as a committee we can apply our mind using the new act that the chairperson likes very much, the act that constitutes this committee, the money bills and related matters amendment act, because I think if we actually put our foot down as this committee, looking at the unspent funds, we can actually relieve the tension in South Africa to say that, no, we have got problems. We don't have troubles here. We have people who are not able to spend funds. Maybe we should think of developing spending capabilities in government institutions. I think that is our biggest problem. Or improving budgetary skills, because one of the two is true. If other people are not budgeting properly, they deliberately over state figures, or they are unable to budget properly. Or after budgeting, there are people who sit in offices and get salaries and don't spend the money, because if they are not working, they will not be able to spend the money.
Okay, last response.
Thank you. Thanks very much. I'd be happy to come and give a talk anytime. Honestly, just let me know what you want me to talk about. I'll come anytime. Counter-cyclical versus conservative, yeah, they're very, very, very tough question. So I'll duck that question if you don't mind. It's a good question. It's a good question. And I think it needs to be asked, because we have an economic crisis. And we need to get the economy going. There's no doubt about it. And we need to be asking the people in power, what are they doing to try and stimulate the economy, to get growth, to get jobs? It's desperate. And, you know, you must hold your senior politicians to account. That's your job. It's not my job, actually. I do a little bit in the press. I wrote a piece in Business Day. I'll send the connection to you, arguing that the city's agenda, we can do much more to stimulate growth through government being organized and coordinated. Right at the moment, we talked about land, housing, transport. We're not coherent as a government to align spending so that it gets a bigger multiplier effect, putting it simply. Right? So government has to get its act together. That's what the NDP talked about. They're still not doing it very effectively. Underspending is a massive problem. But let me raise a couple of reasons beyond those that you've also said. So I was shocked. I was reading some reports on understanding human settlement. Right, in Gauteng, the metros in Gauteng, they've been spending half their budgets. Human settlements, we desperately need housing, and they're only spending half their budgets. All right, so I'm a supporter of the metros, but on that case, it's clearly failing. Okay, because budgets have been growing. Human settlements budget has been growing faster than other budgets in the last few years. Now, there are some reasons that are given. One is the late transfer of the resources from the provinces. Right, they blame the provinces for only handing over the cash too late for them to plan, to project, manage, to spend it effectively. Okay, so that needs to be looked into, the way the provinces sit on the funding often. Second issue they raise is the very tough rules about spending, with supply chain management, with tendering, with... Now, there are good reasons often for these rules around avoiding the abuse of funds, right? However, they can really tie the hands of spending and make it very difficult to spend money. So I think that has to be looked at. Have we got the balance right between compliance procedures and the need to spend and deliver? And the third issue, it seems to me quite important, is that many officials are very risk averse, actually. Because of all the scrutiny, because of the danger of getting things wrong, many officials, particularly less experienced officials, right, are nervous about doing their job, because there could be all sorts of consequences. So they do tend to sit back rather than actively devise projects and commit and invest actively. So there's a mindset of caution which we have, I think, created and not done enough to overcome around delivery. You come across that in many municipalities. That, you know, you're not rocking the boat. You're safe. You're not doing anything that might lead to a problem, and that means no, it's not spending. Right? There's less adverse impact of not spending than there is from spending and having a problem.
Okay, last question. From the research point of view, well, the point that I will make the system to go through the system in order to be able to spend. You cut our capacity by half in terms of doing research on time and delivering time. So that is a critical point that needs to be looked at. And that's perspective from another side, not just the financial one.
last comment. I just saw that the comment on separation and capacity. I think my own view is that the problem is in Syria is a different type of interaction with the training and developing units in time. The one is facilitating training for volunteering. Previous conversations was that there is a need to make sure that the training is related to the principal responsibilities of volunteering as legislators. The change in the secret because of the date of the late last year to see, I'm not sure we have a conversation about, because that was one of our recommendations that we made to Parliament based on the interaction with the Speaker and Honourable Skosana at the time. And then the last is that I thought that it would be wise to also share with you that American debt to GDP is around 256%. And you're right, very gentle debt conversation. But the BRICS country in particular are doing fairly well in terms of the top 10 OECD countries use high numbers, Americans are at the top. So it is part of a conversation we need to have.
I think the level of debt amongst developed countries is quite high, hovering in the 90s. I think Japan has 200%. But others are 100%. do you borrow money for?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what Professor Kuroba said. If you borrow money because you want to invest in infrastructure, grow the economy, then you will be able to deal with your debt service cost because the economy is growing, you have more capacity. And that's why it's really a policy choice as to how far you can go. I know that in South Africa we've taken a view that we should try to keep it around the 40s. If it grows, it will grow slowly. But we need to relate it to our capacity to grow the economy. Because if we just continue to borrow and import consumption, all that, we're in big trouble. But it continues to be a debate amongst macroeconomic, fiscal policy analysts, etc. But thank you very much, Professor Stenmaier and the team, for your inputs. It will certainly help us to prepare the report for the appropriation and the appropriations bill for the House. And we'll continue to engage with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Honorable members, we will meet again Friday at to start at 9. So 9 to 11. So we can release people at on Friday. Mm-hmm. We're meeting with the instruments of the meeting. The presentation has been forwarded to all of you. So we'll meet to management 9 to 11 on Friday morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you.